This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Welcome to the Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room. You, me, the top experts, and 28 minutes to get our heads around a big issue. This week, is Scotland once more on the road to independence? The other week, the Prime Minister was photo-opped clutching crabs in Stromness Harbour on Orkney as part of what was seen as another of his Charm Scotland visits. But judging by the polls, the country may take some charming. 6 years ago, Scotland voted decisively to remain part of the United Kingdom, but recent polls suggest a significant shift towards supporting independence, and there are elections to the Scottish Parliament next May. So is there a path to another independence referendum? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. ...2014, pre-Brexit, pre-virus, seems like a lifetime ago now. But we need to go back further still to trace the evolution of Scottish nationalism from fringe movement to dominant political force. Alan Little has reported on that change, on devolution and the referendum itself for the BBC. So we asked him to try and help us understand how it all happened.
I grew up in rural southwest Scotland in the 1970s. The house my family lived in was called Rhodesia. It had been built at the dawn of the 20th century by two brothers who'd spent their working lives in the colonial service in southern Africa and had come home to retire. It connected our remote home to some distant, sun-dappled and dreamily exotic place on the other side of the world. And we had Britain's global reach to thank for that connection.
Come with us to the Great Empire Exhibition at Bellahouston Park, Glasgow, a noble enterprise that presents the empire to the empire and to the world.
My grandparents were born in the first decade of the 20th century. To them, Scotland was bound into the United Kingdom by the shared enterprise of empire. When they thought of the world, they didn't think of Berlin or Paris or Rome, but of Cape Town and Singapore and Bombay and Barbados.
The Prime Minister was accompanied by Mrs. Churchill when he visited Glasgow.
My parents were born in the 1930s. They lived as children through the shared enterprise of defeating Nazi Germany. And as young adults, they inherited the shared benefits of a British welfare state that had grown out of the war. I was born to the post-war age. The British state counted for much. It schooled you, provided the gas you cooked with and the electricity that lit your home, put the telephone into your hall. It dug coal, milled steel, built ships, provided welfare from cradle to grave. Britain's economic topography was still defined by the imperial age, when raw materials had been shipped in from the colonies and manufactured goods shipped out again, from the country's industrial powerhouses.
For hundreds of years now, Scotland and Wales have been part of Britain, way back in...
Back then, independence campaigners had to explain, implausibly, how they were going to unpick all of that. The burden of proof was too great. All that survived into my own adulthood.
From South Wales across the Yorkshire, from Scotland down to Kent, the miners showed...
If you were a coal miner in Fife, you were connected in a community of shared interests and identity with miners in Yorkshire and South Wales. So too with shipbuilders and steelworkers. These were pan-British enterprises and experiences. Those great industrial communities were not just bedrocks of labour solidarity, they were also bedrocks of British identity in Scotland. And then came the 1980s. The industries were swept away. The communities they had sustained were dispersed, and with them, many of the socio-economic pillars that had held up a sense of Britishness in Scotland were swept away.
Time and again, the Scottish ministerial team have richly earned the collective title, which I believe some jealous Sassenachs imposed upon them, that of the Tartan Mafia.
Scotland did not want to walk the path mapped out by Margaret Thatcher. It voted against it at every opportunity. But as part of the United Kingdom, it had to. Over 18 years, that experience transformed the way Scotland thought about its place in the Union.
This morning, we're going to witness the symbolic start to a new chapter in Scotland's history, and indeed the history of the United Kingdom.
The result was the Scottish Parliament. When I was reporting the 2014 independence referendum, I lost count of the number of times my friends in London quoted back at me the line from P.G. Wodehouse that it's never hard to distinguish between a ray of sunshine and a Scotsman with a grievance. And in all sincerity, I say to friends who want the Union to stay together, if you think this is about grievance, you are fighting the wrong enemy. The threat to the Union you value is much more powerful than that. For support for that union is strong only among older age groups. For younger generations, increasingly drawn to the independence case, it is not grievance that fuels their support, but something much more dangerous, hope. I heard it again and again on the campaign trail in 2014. Why do you support an independent Scotland? Because I want a better society, a fairer one. Not, I want my nation to be great, but I want my country to be good. For the cause of independence has aligned itself not with the flag and symbols of national identity, but with the cause of social justice, of greater equality, and perhaps counterintuitively, with openness and internationalism and support for EU membership. Remain sentiment has, these last few years, gradually been converging with support for independence. If the Thatcher years transformed the way Scotland thought about devolution, we may be at a similar point now. For Scotland does not want to walk the Brexit path either, but as part of the UK, it will have to. That experience is already changing the country's attitude to independence. The danger for the Union is this, that many, especially among the young, will look across the North Sea and compare their country's fortunes with those of a constellation of small, neighbouring, but independent nation-states in northwestern Europe, bound together in a European Union that most Scots wanted to stay in.
We are absolutely clear now that there is no way that the Remain side can win. It looks as though the gap's going to be something like 52-48, so a four-point lead.
My family moved out of the house called Rhodesia in 1979, just as the former British colony was being reborn as Zimbabwe. Another moment in the long, slow unravelling of the British imperial project. In the same year, as a teenager, I cast my first vote. It was at the Scottish devolution referendum. Scotland was not a colony. It was a partner in the shared enterprise of colonising others. I've used that phrase, shared enterprise, a lot, deliberately so. For what are the shared enterprises now that compare with empire, total war, welfare state, the great nationalised industries to bind us all together? Will future generations look back at what is happening today in Scotland and say this too was the final part of the long, slow unravelling? When I was young, the Union was simply the air we breathed, the space we lived. The burden of proof fell squarely on the case for independence. Now, more and more, that burden is shifting. It is increasingly the Union that is being asked to prove itself as the best form of statehood for the nations of this island.
Anna Little, time to talk numbers. What do we know about why people voted the way they did in 2014 and how things may have changed since? Enter Sir John Curtis, Professor of Politics at Strathclyde University.
There's no doubt there was a relationship between age and how people voted. Not to put too fine a point on it, probably if the referendum had been confined to those who were age 50 and less, then a majority would have voted leave the United Kingdom, voted yes. And it was the views of older voters that in the end of the day gave the unionists their majority. That said, it probably wasn't the very youngest who were most likely to vote yes, but actually rather more those in their 30s, maybe in their 40s. But this wasn't the only demographic difference. Perhaps the most striking one was a difference by gender. Men were much more likely to vote yes than were women. And certainly those people who were living in the most deprived parts of Scotland were amongst those who were most likely to vote yes. One thing, however, that didn't make much of a difference is that Eurosceptics, people who are rather doubtful about the UK's membership of the European Union, were just as likely to vote yes as were those who were rather more Europhile.
OK, so that was 6 years ago. Now, what do the latest polls tell us?
Well, 6 years ago, of course, in the end, 45% of people voted yes and 55% of people voted no. If you take the polls conducted in the second quarter of this year, 2020, then we basically have 52.5% saying they'd vote yes and 47.5% voting no. So we are now in a markedly different position. This is the first time that we've had an extended period of repeated polling, on average putting yes ahead and mostly putting yes ahead.
Who has shifted, as far as we can tell?
All those demographic differences we talked about are still in evidence. But what has changed above all is the relationship between people's attitudes towards Europe and their attitudes towards independence. And this is something that began to be evolve in the wake of the 2016 EU referendum on Britain's membership of the European Union, in which, of course, 62% of people in Scotland voted to remain and only 38% to leave. In the wake of that very, very different outcome in Scotland as compared with the rest of the United Kingdom, many of those in the nationalist movement were of the view that, you know, this was the clearest possible example that for so long as Scotland is part of the United Kingdom, it's always at risk of having its democratic wishes, quote unquote, overturned by the rather different views of those living in England. And there were a few polls in the immediate wake of the EU referendum that actually said, yep, the yes are now ahead. But that soon disappeared. And we still kept on showing yes, 45, no, 55. But underneath, something was happening because some people who had voted no to independence in 2014, but then to remain in the European Union in 2016, switched towards yes. But equally, there were some people who had voted yes, but then voted leave. Some of them moved in the opposite direction. Net effect, zero. But in the course of the polls last year, it began to become clear that this was no longer the case. So during the course of 2019, little noticed, the polls on average put yes on 49%. In other words, we were almost at a 50-50 tipping point. And all of the increase in support for yes in 2019 occurred amongst those who had voted remain. So in other words, now the movement of remain voters to yes was outpacing the movement of leave voters towards no. But there is also then beyond that another part of the story, because the question now is, well, why have we now reached a situation where it looks as though yes are actually ahead? Now, you can argue that when you look at the statistics for deaths, difficulties with PPE, what happened in care homes, at least during the height of the coronavirus pandemic, that actually the objective record in Scotland is very similar to that in England. Although more recently, Scotland has had rather greater success in actually reducing the prevalence of the disease. However, the perceptions are very, very different. Boris Johnson gets very high negative ratings, particularly in Scotland, for his handling of coronavirus. Nicola Sturgeon gets very strongly positive ratings. And crucially, that gap isn't just amongst those who voted SNP or amongst those who voted Remain.
Sir John Curtis there with a pretty clear message. The polls strongly suggest support for an independent Scotland is growing, and that if there were a vote tomorrow, the majority might opt to leave the Union. But never mind tomorrow. Will there be another vote any time soon? In other words, is there a path to independence? Jess Sargent is a senior researcher at the Institute for Government, where she focuses on devolution.
The union of the United Kingdom is a reserved matter. So that means it's a matter exclusively for the UK Parliament. So that's widely interpreted to mean that the Scottish Parliament couldn't legislate to hold the independence referendum without a transfer of power from Westminster. The last time they did that, they did it through what's called a Section 30 order. It amends the devolution statutes that give the devolved legislatures the authority to pass legislation to give them the power to hold the second independence referendum. So that was just done on a temporary basis. It was time limited. Once that transfer of power happened, the Scottish Parliament was then able to pass legislation to provide the legal basis for the referendum. So to set the question, to set the date, to set the franchise, and then the referendum was held in accordance with that legislation.
So it was a very temporary transfer of power to the Scottish Parliament to hold that vote that had to be agreed by the UK Parliament for a very specific period.
Yes, absolutely. And it might be that if we did see a Section 30 order transferred again, that it might not be on a temporary basis this time. So the Scottish Government published a big paper after their very successful general election in December last year that kind of made the case for the Scottish Parliament to be devolved the power to decide whether or not to hold an independence referendum on a permanent basis. Obviously, whether the UK Government will agree to that is an entirely different matter.
When that transfer of power for the referendum was held, what was said by the UK government about honouring the results of that referendum and giving enforcement to that, should there have been a vote for independence?
To be honest, the answer is not a huge amount. The referendum was held without a real clear idea of what would happen in the event of a vote for change. That is something that if we had a second independence referendum, there would need to be more thought given to. We saw the problems in the Brexit process of there not being a clear idea of what the UK would look like outside of the EU, what process would need to take place in terms of the negotiations, how long they would take, how they would be sequenced, all those sorts of things. So I think if we were to have a second independence referendum, hopefully there are some lessons to be learnt there.
Sorry, you just told me something. We didn't have any notion of what would happen after a potential yes vote in the 2014 Scottish referendum.
There was some work done by the Scottish Government, and it might have been that there was some kind of preparation within the UK civil service, but certainly there was no clear plan that was published about exactly how that would go.
Is the British government's position at the moment that it will not agree to a second referendum?
Yes, essentially. Alex Salmon said at the time that the 2014 vote was a once-in-a-generation opportunity. And the UK government likes to bring up that quote and says that its position in not granting a second independence referendum is respecting the result of the first one. So really their position is that they don't believe that the circumstances are different enough to mandate a second referendum. Obviously, the Scottish government would argue that things have changed enough. We've obviously had the UK leaving the European Union. But I think the biggest test will come in May at the Scottish Parliament elections. It looks like the SNP are potentially on course to win a majority there. And if they do, it becomes a lot harder for the UK government to argue that the Scottish people don't want a second independence referendum, having just elected potentially a nationalist majority at Holyrood.
What you're saying is the question is whether they can hold that position politically.
Yes, absolutely. What the Scottish government has been trying to do is change the argument from whether there should be Scottish independence to who should have the power to decide whether or not there is a second independence referendum. So I mentioned earlier the paper that the Scottish government had published, which talks about how it should be for the Scottish people through the Scottish Parliament to decide whether or not they should have this expression of self-determination. So that makes it quite difficult for the UK government to continue to kind of hold this position that they won't allow a second independence referendum, because it could potentially play into the kind of SNP's narrative that Westminster is blocking the will of the Scottish people. If it continues to simply kind of say no, there's a risk that that itself might drive support for independence. But equally, if the UK government does grant the Scottish Parliament the power to hold the referendum, then there is a real risk that that might lead to the breakup of the union, which is obviously the last thing that the UK government wants.
Let's suppose for a moment that the UK government actually, though fearing the breakup of the union, does decide that it's not going to grant a referendum. Can Scotland hold a vote of its own?
This is something that has never been legally tested. The Scottish government has never formally conceded that it needs the power from Westminster to hold a referendum. It's only just said that in order to hold a referendum on the clearest possible legal basis, that it does need this Section 30 order, this transfer of power. There is a potential legal argument that holding a referendum is not itself affecting the constitution. All it's doing is mandating the Scottish government to enter negotiations about potentially altering the constitution. So there is a potential argument there that this vote is just consultative and therefore it could be considered within the power of the Scottish Parliament. So potentially what the Scottish government could do is introduce legislation to try and hold a referendum without this transfer of power. It's likely that if they did that, that would be challenged in the UK Supreme Court. But the kind of general legal opinion is because the intention of that referendum would ultimately be to achieve independence, then it's likely that that would be kind of struck down. But even if it wasn't, there's a big question for the Scottish government because it's unlikely that a referendum held on a potentially shaky legal basis might command the widespread legitimacy they would need. There's questions of whether unionist voters might try and boycott that referendum. If it wasn't internationally recognised, there might be problems for an independent Scotland in joining the EU, especially considering member states like Spain who've had similar problems in Catalonia. So for the moment, the Scottish government has made it very clear that their preferred route to independence would be through this agreed position, the way that it happened in 2014. But obviously the SNP is going to come under increased pressure from its grassroots if the UK government continues to say no in the not near future.
Jess Sargent. So that's how a vote could happen. Finally, to the inevitably speculative part of the programme, what if the vote were to happen? How might it differ from the campaign in 2014? To answer that, I'm joined from Scotland by two political correspondents, Lindsay Buse from BBC Scotland and Alastair Grant from the Herald newspaper. Lindsay Buse.
Well, I actually think that these big issues that dominated in 2014, I think would dominate again, but in a different context because things have changed. We will still be seeing, I think, a debate about an independent Scotland's membership of Europe, but with the UK having already left. And on the economy as well, one of the huge factors that played large in 2014 was what future currency would Scotland use? And at the time, a currency union was being put forward by the Yes side as the model it would like to follow. Now it says it would use the pound for a time and then move to its own currency. But there would still be big questions about the cost of that, the deficit that Scotland would be left with, and how the economy would be managed going forward.
I mean, just to carry on from that, I think from a unionist pro-UK perspective, the border between England and Scotland will be a big issue. You know, if an independent Scotland seeks to join the EU, then Scotland's border with England is going to be an external border of the EU. And that kind of throws up the prospect of things like regulatory and customs checks. And I think for the pro-union side, you know, those who are against independence, that's going to be a really, really important argument. And it has a lot of emotional weight. Any talk of barriers going up will have a kind of emotional, symbolic impact on people.
When I was talking to John Curtis earlier, one of the things he slightly suggested was that people's views of whether these things are problems or not actually tend to follow their views about whether independence is a good idea or not, rather than the other way around. So, Alastair, broadly speaking, if you wanted to paint a kind of optimistic picture of independence, you'd say this will be great, we'll have opportunities in the European Union, so don't worry so much about the United Kingdom. And if you want to stay in the United Kingdom, you'll say exactly the opposite.
Exactly, yeah. And I think that whole kind of dynamic plays out on pretty much all the debates when it comes to this issue. I mean, even if you just look around the issues right now of uncertainty, you know, we've had this period of huge upheaval in politics and society. You know, the pro-union side might say, you know, is this really the time to opt for further uncertainty? Whereas I think for the SNP and for the pro-independence side, remaining in the UK is no longer an option of certainty in the way that it could have been painted in 2014.
OK, I'm going to ask both of you to be Olympian, truly Olympian, and to try to give advice to either side in the debate about the strengths and weaknesses of their arguments and where they should put the emphasis. Lindsay?
If they were in that position, they would be reflecting on what happened in 2014 and trying to learn the lessons of that. I think there are already signs that they're perhaps looking to develop more positive arguments. Boris Johnson gave himself the title of Minister for the Union, and we've seen UK ministers coming to Scotland trying to really emphasise UK government spending in the Scottish economy, how the UK government is using its own powers, its own fiscal powers, to do some work in Scotland. And we've seen that particularly recently with the pandemic and the money that's been spent on the furlough scheme by the Treasury. On the yes side, well, they have already revised their economic prospectus.
Alistair, your chance to be Olympian.
I think for the pro-union side, one of their main weaknesses is Boris Johnson, to be honest, in the Conservative government. They're just not popular in Scotland. And I think you can expect the SNP and the pro-independence side to continue to draw attention to that. And I think this is something that Mr. Johnson himself is all too aware of. You know, he has visited Scotland 5 times since becoming Prime Minister. I think in 2 of those visits, he took questions from journalists from within secure military bases. And I think if you contrast Boris Johnson and Nicola Sturgeon, you know, Nicola Sturgeon has seen really impressive approval ratings during the coronavirus crisis.
Now, this raises a really tricky problem, I imagine, for the anti-independent side, the pro-union side, which is the obvious figurehead for pro-independence is already there, Nicola Sturgeon. But the likely main figurehead for the other side of the campaign, the Prime Minister, is not popular in Scotland.
I think it's quite difficult to identify an obvious candidate for that task. After Ruth Davidson stepped down as Scottish Conservative leader, she's going to be quitting Holyrood. She's no longer going to be a prominent figure in the debate here in Scotland. Had she not taken that decision, had she carried on as leader, then I think she would have been the obvious candidate. But the person who succeeded her, Jackson Carlaw, has only spent 5 months in that job as Scottish Conservative leader and has now resigned, and a new leader has just been appointed. Douglas Ross would be someone that not many people would know outside of political circles and is a bit of an unknown quantity at the moment. We don't really know if he's going to have the same cut through, the same dynamism, perhaps, that Ruth Davidson presented when she was out on the campaign trail. And then in Labour, well, some of the big hitters we saw feature heavily in the 2014 campaign, Alistair Darling, Gordon Brown, and to a lesser extent, people like Jim Murphy. And, well, I think it's unlikely that any of them would come back to really lead a campaign.
Oh, what about Keir Starmer?
Yeah, I think in a way, Keir Starmer has kind of still got something to prove in Scotland in that sense. He does have that recognition factor. People know who he is, but I don't think they know precisely what he stands for. And I think one of the problems that Labour have in Scotland is that Scottish Labour as a force is so diminished.
You know, many people consider that Labour sharing a platform with the Conservatives in Scotland at the last referendum caused a huge amount of problems for the party because it became so closely associated with the Tories in Scotland. And, you know, that has always been something that's been brought back up to attack the party by the SNP. So I think it would be very interesting to see if we saw the unionist parties all come together in one campaign again, or if they tried to run their own campaigns in Scotland.
Finally, Lindsay and Alistair, will there be a referendum and will it go in favour of independence, yes or no?
I think there will be another vote at some point. As to what the result will be, I like to sit on the fence.
I think there will be a referendum. And put it this way, if I was a unionist, if I was in the pro-UK side, I would be extremely worried.
Alistair Grant and Lindsay Bewes. And my thanks also to Alan Little, Jess Sargent and Sir John Curtis. My conclusion is a guess based on what we've heard. A big electoral victory next May for parties supporting another referendum would make the UK Parliament denying that referendum untenable. And for the moment, that's the way we seem to be headed. We'll be back at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. It was produced by Beth Sagar-Fenton, Kirstine Knight and Joe Kent. It was mixed by Neva Masirian and the editor was Richard Varden. If you enjoyed this podcast, you may find other episodes interesting, including on what's happening to the Uyghurs in China, on the use of local lockdowns to tackle coronavirus, and on how to do a trade deal. You can find them all and much, much more on BBC Sounds.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.